Hey, family. My name is Chris Beck. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm real nervous and real jittery and real grateful and very honored to be here. This is my second rock. And last October, I was helping my good friend Bill Sanders pack up his van to go back to Atlanta. And he gave me this rock, him and the seagull right here, and said, put this in that white box. And I said, okay. So I put it in the white box, and I was carrying it to the van. And he said, no, you need to hold on to that until March. I said, okay, this is pretty cool. I get to come back. And I said, yeah. Little did I know that I would be up here talking to all of you drunks. And I have to be very honest, I didn't want to do this. But, you know, I also didn't want to miss this place, and I think all of you know exactly what I'm talking about. Just to give you a little bit of background about myself, I was born and raised in, Alabama. And some are sicker than others. y'all are killing me. I grew up in a little town, and everybody knew everybody, and my dad is an alcoholic, and he celebrated 5 years in December, and we moved from one small town to another because of his drinking, and then high school... I didn't touch alcohol. I thought alcohol was for bad people. And all y'all are bad, and I don't want to be bad. So I didn't drink until I got to college. Because in college it's okay. Right. So by the time I got to college, my dad was in recovery. He had gone to a treatment center in Atlanta. And Christmas my freshman year, I went for family week. And I was wasted. I was drunk, and I don't really remember anything about being there. And I really didn't care. You know, it was my dad's fault and my dad's problem. And you know, I was angry at what he had done to me and ruined a marriage, and you know, my life was gone. Well, that's what I thought, at least. But I started drinking real heavy in college. I started drinking every weekend. Freshman year was every weekend. I was talking to a friend of mine this morning, several of them, about the very first time I ever got drunk. I didn't know anything about drinking. I didn't know that this much liquor and this much beer were separate. I thought that if you had this much liquor and this much beer, it was the same thing. But we all know that it's about like that. Well, I started drinking Jack Daniels straight out of a glass. I didn't know. So, after two or three glasses, I was waiting for the effects, you know, and next thing I know, I'm scatterbrained, and a friend of mine said, you know, you need to calm down, and I was going to show him, so I swung and missed and did one of those little spins, you know, and freaky like I am, started running, because I didn't want him to swing at me, so I'm running. And I'm looking for him, and I don't see him. And I don't see this tree right in front of me either. And I clotheslined myself on this tree. And the tree happened to be in the president's front yard. How appropriate. The next thing I know, besides the lack of skin on my neck, was that my RA was holding me by my hair over the toilet and, you know, heaving my stomach at the same time. And I slept it off the next day. I went to class. I did my work, and I was like, dude, when can I do that again? What kind of sickness is that? Well, that's how my drinking started, and it kind of leveled itself out, and then, of course, as we all know, we all get here by choice. My drinking career progressed very fast. I only drank for 6 years, only. You know, that may, you know, I know that there are a lot more elaborate stories than my own, but I do what I can, you know. Yeah, I'm from Alabama. Give me a break. No, I stopped drinking liquor after that. I didn't think that it didn't taste right, you know. So I started drinking beer, and a lot of it, and I got out of control. I was I jumped out of cars, going 50 miles an hour down the road, just because I didn't want to be there anymore. I was my senior year of college. I was elected to be a model senator or whatever you want to call it from my school, a delegate from my school to Washington D.C. And me and five other people from my school went to Washington and went to the OAS building, the Organization of American States building, and Senate building and Capitol Hill, and did all this fun stuff. And we were staying in a hotel downtown, which is right across the street from George Mason or George Washington. I don't recall now. It's really not important. But I started talking trash to some of the frat boys that were across the street, and they didn't like that too much. But I figured it'd be a good idea if I walked on over. But I was on the 20th floor, so I crawled out of my window, and the next thing I know, I got cops, and I got the what do you call it? It's not the maitre d', but yeah, the concierge, thanks. Oh man, I had blue lights and red lights, and it was interesting, and my teacher at school was not very impressed. By the time I graduated college, I was drinking every weekend, every day. I remember I had two classes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I had an 8:30 a.m. and a 2:30 p.m. Are you kidding me? Like, I'm going to get up for the 8:30 class because I'm still hungover. And by the time I got up, I was already drinking, so I missed the 2:30. So it's like, I don't know. Go figure. But I graduated college. Dean's List. It was my freshman year. Go back a little bit. My freshman year, I made a 1.7 on a 4-point, and for all of you rocket scientists out there, that's not good. And my mom and my dad, who were fortunate enough to send me to school, said I could either shape up or ship out. And my mom was very clear. She said, I'm not talking about anything except a boat, and you're going to be mopping it because I'm not paying for your screw-ups. And second semester of freshman year, I brought my 1.7 up to a 2.3, so I made somewhere around a 3.8 that semester. And I kind of maintained that all 4 years of college, which was difficult and easy at the same time. I was managing my drinking and I was managing my school. And I graduated. I looked good on the outside, or so I thought. But inside, I was raging. I was angry all the time. I was violent and confused and all those things that we are. And so I graduated school. And I moved down here with now fiance at the time. She was my girlfriend. She's from Atlanta originally. We moved down from, I went to school in Virginia. And moved down to Atlanta and got an apartment. And everybody in the apartment, it was insane. The guy that lived below me would pass around a tray. It'd have pills on one part of the tray, it'd have Coke in the middle of the tray, it'd have joints on it, it'd just have it. Whatever you wanted, whenever you wanted. And I never got into anything except alcohol. That was my thing. I got way too much trouble with that as it was. I started drinking real heavy at the apartment, and this might blow some of you away, but my story is my story. I started sniffing gas, and
I understand.
It smells good, and I wanted to know what it tasted like, so I tasted it, and it burns. And I do some painting on the side. I paint murals and I do canvases and stuff. And I had some paint thinner, and I started getting into paint thinner and gas and just weird stuff. Talk about insane. This was, I guess, almost a year and a half ago that I started doing this kind of stuff. And, I was doing all right at work. One night, my boss invited me out for a thank you kind of party, to show his appreciation. And four of us went out, and I don't even know how many pitchers of beer we had, but we got real drunk, and I was driving home, and I thought it'd be a good idea to go car shopping. So I went car shopping, and I pulled into the little place where you go car shopping, and there was a gate, I didn't go past the gate, but I got out and I was looking at, it was a pickup truck. I'm from Alabama. So I'm looking at this truck and it's not what I'm looking for, so I get in my truck and I'm driving off. And I got that moment of clarity that we all talk about in the form of blue lights. I was drunk enough to be drunk, but I knew I was sober enough to know that I was going to jail. And I was just that feeling, that buzzkill when you know you're busted, you know? I mean, like, dude, this sucks. I knew I was going to jail, and I'm sitting there, I'm going to jail. The whole time I'm looking through my truck, do I have anything to put in my mouth? I'm going to jail. Cop comes over, he knocks on my window, and he just kind of did one of those things. How much you have to drink? Not, have you been drinking, but how much? And then he starts talking trash. Don't lie to me, boy, I can smell it, and I know you've been drinking. So, after a roundabout discussion, two beers, he gets me out and, you know, does the whole field sobriety stuff and does that thing. Have any of you had to ever do a sobriety? It's not important. Yeah, the thing where you had to point your toe and count. No? Okay. So, I thought the guy said count to 30. But he said count to 15. So I'm sitting there counting 22, 23, and I'm just doing this number, and he's just laughing up a storm. He's like, dude, you can quit. And I'm like, dude, I'm not to 30 yet. So he said, you know, you put your hands behind your back in a clapping position. And I'm like, it's like, no, behind your back. So anyway, that was interesting. But I remember sitting in that jail cell thinking to myself, the next time I come back, the least they can do is clean up my jail cell. You know what I'm saying? You know, that was my last drunk. And how am I doing on time? Okay, 5 or 6 minutes. Okay, so, I lost my place. Okay, so I got arrested. Yeah, that was my last drunk. And, I decided it would be a good thing to come to AA and look good for mom and dad. You know, this would be, you know, a way to get them off my back, and then I could kind of skeeze out of this thing and then go back to my old stuff. And I got in touch with the lawyer for the DUI thing, and he said, yeah, you need to go see an evaluator, which is code for shrink, you know. And I had an evaluation, and she decided that I needed to go to some AA meetings, and I said, I'm already going. And she said, well, you need to do this for the judge. And I said, okay. So I started going to AA meetings twice a week. And then I met that guy right there. And hey, Jeff. He says to me one day, I came up to him and I said, can I ask you a question? He's like, you're going to do 90 and 90? You're going to call me every day? I didn't even get anything out before he's telling me what I'm going to do. And I gave him a hard time about it, but it was a funny thing. And yeah, y'all killed me. Yeah, I was going to go back out, and I was going to have my fun, and I wasn't going to have anything to do with y'all, because y'all were psycho, drunk, weirdo freaks. I didn't want it. I didn't want any of it. Just like I didn't want to be up here. But, it took me a long time to hear my story and to hear somebody tell what I needed to hear, say what I needed to hear. And I don't know if it's magic or not. It's not an illusion for me. This thing is real, and it really works. And, you know, it's not me, and it's not any one person. It's the first tradition, and You know, when I die, AA is going to be here. And it's going to be here to help somebody else like me and like you. And this is a great program. And it is powerful. But I don't think it's any magic trick. This is real. And this is a miracle that I'm here. Because there was no way that I was going to get up in front of 30 people. 300 people and talk about me. I'm telling you, well, y'all are killing me. I'm so glad that's over, y'all. I'll close with this. I've shared this before, but when I was a little boy, I used to stand outside and look up at the sky and see little flashing lights of airplanes flash across the sky and just float away. And I didn't know where they were going or who was on them or what they were doing or where they were going to end up. But I knew that I wanted to be on that airplane, going wherever they were going, doing whatever they were doing, and being whatever they were going to be. And I can tell you that today, right here, right now, there's no other place that I'd rather be than sober and loved and loving and at the Rock with a bunch of drunks. And I'm just very honored to have been able to have this opportunity to share a little bit about me with you. So thank you for sharing you with me.
My name is John Evans, and I am a drunk freak, alcoholic, and I'm certainly glad to be here today, and I drove the van that was trying to beat the Winnebago, and I don't know how the heck they got here as quick as they did. You know, we try to get here to get that bottom bunk, y'all know that. Man. Well, I want to tell you that I came from the last house on the street. Literally, I'm in building 54, and it's so far down there that they ran out of concrete for the walk. Now, I'm telling you, that's where I started from. I'm real grateful to be here today, to be at the Rock again. We didn't get here last time in the fall. We sent the forms in the day we get it. We have everything organized, as you know, and we sent it up here, and it took 8 days to get from Jacksonville Beach, Florida, to Atlanta, Georgia. How can that happen? That's the post office, I guess. U.S. government. Is there any postal workers in here? Hey! We gotta do something. If y'all see anything in the future that has the Rock on it, if you would push it a little bit, I'd appreciate it. I started my drinking career in North Carolina at age 16. I went to get drunk. That's what you did back in 1965. Four or five. You went to get drunk, you know, when you were 16, a couple of years before you could legally buy. You had somebody that was 18, you went and got drunk, and that's what I did. I went and got drunk, and that's where it started. I didn't start drinking, I started drunken. And it went from there. And it went from beer to liquor to pot to acid to mescaline to cocaine to smoking it, snorting it, playing with it, looking at it, trying to find some more of it. How many of you have been on the floor trying to find that little thing down there? I've been there. I don't know what I smoked that night. But I smoked a lot of it. I didn't think I'd bought that much. But I sure smoked a lot of it. Man, it was bad. You know, I'm not gonna go into a big drunkalogue, because everybody in this room knows my story. Some of the names were changed. But I do want to tell you about my naked story. I was much thinner then. How many of you got a naked story? Well, I want to tell you, I was smoking cocaine in my condo on the ocean at Ocean 14. It's a 14-story condo. And I was on the 7th floor, and I was smoking cocaine. Of course, you know, you can't smoke cocaine with all your clothes on. It don't work. You know, it gets hot. You get sweaty. Come on. So I'm in there smoking it, drinking a little liquor, you know, smoking a little pot, doing a little, you know, doing this up and down stuff. You know, smoke some cocaine and do a bagging. Oh, God, how come we're here? We shouldn't be here. Anyway, on the 7th floor, I heard, "Come out with your hands on your head." Holy mackerel. They done found me. I'm telling you now, for y'all that smoked that crap know what I'm talking about. Ain't no lie, they were there. They were on the beach. They were on the in the parking lot. Man, they had loud speakers. Come out, come out. You got to obey the law. So I'm sitting there now. I want you to think about this. I'm in my condo with the door locked. Naked. So I ease over to the door. I don't want to get shot. One hand, I open that door, man. I swing that door open now. There's everything. There's Jacksonville Beach. So I ease on out. Come on down. Come down. But keep your hands locked on top of your head and come down. So I walked naked to the elevator. I got in the elevator naked. Now, the funny thing about being in the elevator is when the doors close, you can see yourself. But I wasn't going to unlock my fingers. No. So I take that thing and I hit that button, ground floor. Elevator goes down now. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Y'all that did it know what I mean. I ain't lying. Charlie, I ain't lying. I got down to the bottom. Right? I'm looking at myself. And you would think that you'd think, God, hit the button, go back up, you fool. Not me. They were talking to me. Come on down now. So the door opens. There stands a policeman. Now, I had a moment of clarity. I had a moment of clarity right then. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "You called me down." I ain't lying if you did it, you know what I mean? I ain't lying. He said, "Man, get out of here. We got to get something around you." And, you know, sometimes when you're doing that stuff, you snap in and out. Boy, I snapped out quick right then. Holy mackerel. This guy said, "What in the world are you doing?" I said, "Well, you know, God, you know, I don't know. I mean, I was hearing voices and seeing people and da-da-da." He said, "Well, you know, I got two choices here. I can take you to jail or I can take you to the hospital." What you gonna pick? I done been to jail. That wasn't fun. I said, "Man, you need to take me to the hospital. I'm sick." So they called this ambulance over there, you know, and they had this sheet around me and they got me in that ambulance and they were, you know, we were booking on to the hospital, and I went in the emergency room, and she and I was still hallucinating hearing those people talk about, "Man, this guy's got so much cocaine in his body, it's a wonder he's still alive." And then the doctor came out and he said, "Well, Mr. Evans, we checked a little bit, you know, we did some tests and all, and you haven't been eating regular lately, have you?" I said, "Well, I've been a little stressed." And he says, "You know, you're a little dehydrated." I said, "Oh, man, that's... Doc, if you let me out of here, I'll go get some Gatorade and a hamburger. And I'll be all right." He said, "Well, man, you know, you got to drink fluids and you got to eat regular, and... you know, I know you're going through this divorce, you know, and da-da-da. But you still got..." I said, "Oh, man, I can't believe it. I just forgot to eat. I got a cab. On the way back to the condo, I went by Burger King and the 7-Eleven, just like I told him I was going to do, get a hamburger and a Gatorade. Ate it, drank it. Got to the condo, everything was wonderful. I was dehydrated and malnourished, and that's why all that happened. It didn't have nothing to do with that, smoking that cocaine. Not even a bit. So y'all know the rest of the story. I sat down there and kept on. I kept on, and I kept on, and I kept on, and I kept on. And if it wasn't for a drunk buddy of mine in Miss Ellie's, the nicest topless joint in Jacksonville, Florida, telling me, the both of us drunk, telling me, "John, I think you got a problem with your alcohol." I said, "Well, if I got a problem, you got a problem." He said, "Yeah, but yours is worse." That's coming from your drinking buddy. I mean, come on. Give me a little bit of a break. And he said, if I find somebody for you, will you go talk to them? And you know, I was right at that edge. You know the edge we get to that, boy, you could fall either way. And I said, "Sure, I'll go talk to him." So he set something up, and I went and talked to this doctor that was had dealt in alcoholism and drug addiction. And, you know, first thing he said is, you know, I can give you some antabuse. And I said, that ain't going to work for me because I ain't going to take it. The only way antabuse works is you got to take it. I said, I ain't got to be another way. He said, well, you know, they got this Charter Charm School up there in Georgia. And I said, well, you know, I haven't been very charming lately. So maybe I ought to go to that. So they sent me on up there, and I went to Charter in St. Simon's. And I walked in, and they said, you know, phew, with all this cocaine abuse and all, we probably need 6 weeks. I said, well, you know, I got a hunting trip in 30 days. So I'll give you 30, matter of fact, 28 days, because I'm going on this hunting trip. I done sent them my $55, and I'm going. In 6 weeks, I said, please don't send me out of here. Please, God, please don't let me. Please don't let me go. Go out there and that stuff. Well, I went out. I got out, and I went back home in Jacksonville Beach and started going to Penman Road, which is my home group, Penman Road. And I was at a meeting one day. I had about, I don't know, a couple months clean and dry. See, I don't think you get sober for until a while. I think you get dry and clean. Then you get sober and get sobriety. So if you ain't getting dry and clean, you can't get sobriety. I don't think. Is Charlie, stand up, Charlie. I want you to stand up, Charlie. Yeah, you see, you're going to get my butt. I'm going to get your butt. Now, hey. Now, stand up, but don't talk. You can't, it's my podium. You can't talk.
Put your hands on top of your head.
Charlie. My sobriety date is December 28th, 1984. So I've been sober for a little over 16 years. And Charlie was at that meeting when I was about 2 months sober. And in the meeting I said, you know, I just want to tell you that I'm going to go down here to the bar because Sweetie is going to be there and I'm going to have some Coca-Colas with her. And after the meeting, I heard this voice from across the room. Hey, boy, come here. You're getting ready to get drunk. I said, who is that fool talking to? He certainly isn't talking to me. But he was. I was that fool getting ready to go get drunk. And Charlie was my first sponsor back then, and I love you, man. I do with all my heart because I'm here today because Charlie took his time to stand up, not wait for me to go say, would you be my sponsor? Because he stood up and said, you're going to get drunk, fool. He took that step. You know, sometimes I take that step, and sometimes, unfortunately, I don't. And I wish that I did. And but I have been clean and sober since that day. Now, I quit drinking November 4th, 1984. I quit drugging December 28th, 1984. I celebrate December 28th because I'm clean and sober. Clean and sober. See, there's some that come in and try the marijuana maintenance program and some other drugs, and it just, folks, I'm just telling you, it don't work. It just don't work. It just don't work. If you want serenity in sobriety, you gotta not drink, not drug, and work the 12 steps of recovery. Because you can go to every meeting in town. You can talk to every other drunk in town. You can do all of those other things that are available out there. But if you want to be serene in your sobriety, you have to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. No joke, no kidding. This is serious stuff. People are dying right now today because they're dancing around this program. This is no dress rehearsal. This is the play. This is it. This is absolutely it. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous showed me a God that I don't quite understand today. but it showed me a God. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous got rid of that self-pity. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous got rid of that remorse and guilt. Y'all know that remorse and guilt? Oh, man. Eats at you like a cancer. Horrible. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous got rid of that. Not just going to meetings. That's the power of these 12 steps. They have allowed me, John Evans, to be a useful, well, some of my buddies may not say this now, a useful member of society today. Sometimes. I got a good group of guys here that we hang around. I mean a good group. That the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, have done so much in my life. I have come from absolute bankruptcy. Absolute bankruptcy in sobriety to owning two businesses and being financially secure. Just things that you would never absolutely... what can I say in 5 minutes? Because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, these things have occurred in my life. And, you know, it's the promises. I know a new freedom and a new happiness today because of those 12 steps. I do not regret the past, nor do I wish to shut the door on it today because of the 12 steps. I don't have a fear of financial insecurity. You know, these 12 steps taught me to suit up and show up. Boy, that's all I did for a long time. And worked these steps, and things evolved because I kept doing that. I kept showing up. And things happened in my life that there's no reason for them to happen. I'm going to tell you, you can't get from where I was to where I am. There ain't no way. There ain't a road. And are you all working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous today? Are you all working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous today? Well, let me tell you how it's working in your life. What would you have settled for when you walked in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what have you got today? Sometimes I forget that what I would have settled for was to brush my teeth without gagging. That was a big step for me, to brush my teeth without gagging. Holy mackerel. To lay in bed at night and not sweat and shake. What would I have settled for when I came in? And what I have today, I don't know. I just don't know. I want to read something if I could. Are they on straight? That is written in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's the last two paragraphs on page 164. And whenever I share, I try to read this because it's really, you know, it really touches my heart. And our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something that you have not got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of the past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. Not to happy destiny, of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. You know, I really appreciate everyone that puts on this event up here. Mike and Larry and Bill and Sarge and, you know, everybody. And I've been coming up here for probably, I don't even know how long now. And, boy, when I get back, you know, my wife loves me. I don't understand the correlation there. I seem to go back and I'm just calm. You know, my employees like me. There. They call me some nasty names before I leave. When I get back, I'm just, God, will you go up there and stay? Man. This place, if you haven't been here before, either when you leave or next week or 2 weeks, it will happen to you. I promise you, it will happen. You will, man, just wake up and say, oh, that feeling. I even know one friend of mine that when we got the message for the next rock, that's when he got it. But I want to tell you that I appreciate the opportunity to be up here with you. And I love each and every one of you. It ain't a damn thing you can do about it. Thank you.
I'm Les, I'm an alcoholic. Now what more, I want you to ask yourself what I've been asking me. What more could I possibly say? Think about it. We've had two guys come up here and pretty much carry this message, and I know that I got some hope out of both of you. I want to say this. I am one of those psycho weirdos. Thank you. The thing that amazes me, you know, I heard about all these designer drugs since I've been here, but I ain't never done any 93 octane, have you? I was sitting over there thinking, 93 octane. I drank some shit that was like 93 octane. You know, I'd have probably done it. I'm a pig. We're supposed to be honest here, right? You know, the power and the magic of the steps. I have a lot of fear sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And I find that fear manifests itself in anger, and then I try to look at my part. I was at a meeting recently, and, you know, as I say this, in no way am I slamming Alcoholics Anonymous. If life was fair, I'd be dead or drunk. Thank God life isn't fair. But, you know, I hear in meetings that I attend in some places, and, you know, don't worry about the steps. You know, just sit there and talk about yourself. You know, share your feelings. You know, tell us what you think. I'm damn glad they didn't ask me those questions. The reason I say I fear it is because I really believe that if you're new here today, you know, what they told me when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous was to make meetings, read the book, and don't drink one day at a time. And somewhere along the line, I'd have to make the leap. And the leap is to get under the influence of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps and get out of under the influence of me. Now, when I'm drinking, I'm under the influence of me and a drink. That's not a good combination. And I'm glad I didn't hear the message that being sober was somehow not drinking was going to make me happy. I'd had a lot of bouts with that, had you? You know, I remember one time I spent 27 months and I didn't drink a drop of alcohol, and it was the most miserable existence of my life. And, you know, it's kind of like that alcoholic dilemma, you know? If I can't drink, I can't get any drunker and I can't get any higher. And when the blue light finally catch up with me, I can't be any more miserable in this existence. So the dilemma is I'm caught in the middle, ain't I? And I think the 12 steps were honestly designed for me to learn how to live life without a drink. I want to keep it simple. For me to learn how to live life without a drink. They told me to remember my last drunk when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the most important one. I don't remember the drunk, but I remember the experience. And the experience is kind of sad, and then the experience was the first time in my entire life that I actually said to myself and to another human being, I need help. You ever been there? I woke up at St. Catherine's Hospital in a detoxification unit. Notice I said I woke up. And for the last 15 years, I was a failure. I was a loser. And by my own admission, conceded to my innermost self, I truly was an alcoholic. And I woke up in this detoxification unit, and you ever been to a Catholic hospital? You know, I wasn't any particular denomination. I guess it didn't matter to me where they put me, but I was there. And I woke up and I had some strange sensations. Some really strange sensations. It's a true story. And I lifted the sheet and I looked down there and I knew my penis wasn't that long. I looked over at my left arm and I had something going in my left arm and I felt up by my nose. And I had something going in my nose. And it was obvious to me these were tubes, but I was questioning, now how is that thing coming out of my penis? So I don't know what I did. I think I rattled the bottle and whatever you do when you're in that state of mind. And she ran in there and I said, well, what is that? She pulled the sheet back and pulled it and I let out a war whoop they heard three halls down, you know? I thought it was going to go right through my nose and out, you know? Don't do that. The honest to God truth. Second thought I had was, man, I need a cigarette. How long have I been laying in here? I'm beyond nicotine here. In them days, they let you smoke. So I got up, you know, and I don't know how you were, but I was pretty slick, hip, and cool. You know what I'm saying? Even when I was dying. Even dying, I'm slick, hip, and cool, you know. Anyway, I put that gown on. I don't know why they made them where your ass hangs out, but I put it on, and she told me to go down to that nurse's station there, you know, and get you a cigarette. And I remember walking down the hall, and I remember this vividly, and I kept looking over my shoulder and holding that gown, hoping nobody was looking at my ass when I was going down it, you know. We talk about moments of clarity. I didn't have one walking down the hall. I didn't have one waking up in that detox bed. But I had one when she told me to go over in that room and have your cigarette. And I didn't have it when I walked in the room. I sat down on the bench and I lit that cigarette up and I looked around. And I was the only guy there. And, you know, it's emotional to me because it was in that moment that I was the saddest and the loneliest I'd ever been in my life. And I hadn't probably drew a sober breath in I don't know how long. And I sat there and I really didn't have any friends and I really didn't have any enemies and I surely didn't have any place to go. And I smoked that cigarette. Somewhere, you know, we've read here that it's incomprehensible demoralization and it's loneliness that always gets us. That's what got me. And I realized that my best efforts were right there, as sad as that may be. And I don't want you to get the impression that I was always a loser, and I don't want you to get the impression that I, at some point in my life, decided to be an alcoholic. And I don't want you to get the impression that I was struck sober and wanted to be an alcoholic. The last thing that I thought at that time is that I was an alcoholic. I thought an alcoholic was a guy that was probably in his 60s and had a pint in his back pocket and a brown bag, you know, and he had piss all over the front of him, you know, and he was just broke down and busted. I was broke down, but I surely wasn't 60, and I wasn't living in a Westinghouse cardboard box. You know, I knew how to get around to them houses. You know them houses, don't you? Anyway, that night, one of them nurses called somebody. And I want you to know that all the judges I ever went before, and I've been before a few judges, and they always had the right guy. All the judges, all them social workers, all them people that, you know, you end up going before, you know, and you sit there with glassy eyes and you're looking at them and saying, man, when's this going to be through? Why don't you shut up? Why don't you just do what you got to do? I'm too slick, hip, and cool to even hear this bullshit, you know? You know where I'm at, right? But nobody ever said anything about alcoholism or drug addiction. I'm a byproduct of the late 60s, and I had shot dope and drank alcohol excessively through the whole 70s, and I bottomed out in the 80s. And when I sat in that detoxification unit at St. Catherine's Hospital, I didn't have a wife, I didn't have a dog, I didn't have a car, I didn't have any children I knew of. I didn't have a job, I didn't have a home, I didn't have a credit card, I didn't have a bank account. What I had was a resume that wasn't going to get me across the street. And then he came. I shouldn't say he. I should say they. And I know I look bad. I probably felt worse than I looked. I had real long hair and it was stuck out. And I had these yellow and green abscesses, and I don't mean to offend anybody in the room. I know that Alcoholics Anonymous singleness of purpose is around alcohol, but again, I came through an era where you're a pig, you know what I'm saying? And I had yellow and green abscesses up and down my arms, and the nurses told me I'd been puking yellow and green mucus out of my stomach, and somebody had been wiping my rear end while I was out, and I was humiliated and I was alone, and they told me that there was another way. That wasn't real appealing. Was it appealing to you? You know, I love it when I see somebody really catch on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. But I didn't necessarily feel any fire. But the first time I'd ever heard, and I know I'm supposed to talk about the steps, so I don't want to get into a big drunkalogue, but the first time I'd ever heard what was wrong with me was those three men. And those three men were between 30 and 34 years older than I was. And they told me that we could do what I could never do. Now I tell you that I knew I wasn't I didn't know if I was an alcoholic, but I had that voice. You know that voice? You know, that gray zone we go in? You know? That voice where in your mind saying, man, I gotta stop. And the craving and obsession that dominate that voice is so overwhelming that you gotta drink. I'm sure a lot of people in this room have been there. But many, many mornings I woke up and I told myself, I gotta stop. This has gotta stop. And it couldn't. It couldn't for this reason. The guy that told me his name was Dirty Louie. Dirty Louie. Gary S. and Six Pack Pete. He said, Les, we're powerless over an allergy of the body coupled with the obsession of the mind. And when you drink alcohol, you break out. And we all know what I break out in. It ain't rashes. It's drunk. And I'll leap a little bit. I heard not too long after that in Alcoholics Anonymous, I struggled with this whole powerlessness thing. I know some of you just accept it. Come on, man. Come on. But I was in a meeting and I heard a guy say, you know something? I never walked in a tavern and ordered a blackout. You know, I was losing a little bit of my slick hip and cool in that, just in that comment. I never walked in a tavern and ordered anything that alcohol ever gave me. But I never knew that. He told me we're powerless over an allergy of the body coupled with the obsession of the mind. And I definitely had that allergy. Alcohol, I drank alcohol despite my will not to drink alcohol. You hear me? I drank alcohol and I did other drugs despite what happened to me. Despite who I hurt. You know, and in that moment of clarity, I'm sure a lot of you had it. You know, I'm a real selfish, self-centered alcoholic when I'm under the influence of me or alcohol. And if you take alcohol out of me and I'm just under the influence of me, I'm even more selfish and self-centered. And everything in that moment was about what happened to me. And it was those men that started helping me to understand what happened to them. How about all those people that were in my life that I went through worse than a hurricane, and none of them had a drop of alcohol in them? I never for one moment stepped back and took a look at the fact, the violations that I put on those people. Now I want to say this in a nutshell. When I looked at the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, sober, physically sober, I liked what you said. And I really took a look at them. Come on, they don't make no sense, do they? I'm supposed to admit I'm powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. There ain't nobody in my life ever told me I was powerless over anything. How about you? Come on. And come to believe that something greater than me is going to restore me to sanity? How do you get restored to something you ain't never had? And now you want me to turn Christian on me, huh? You know how many jail cells I've laid in, man, and the preacher would come around and he'd want to give me the pamphlet on Sunday morning. I'd throw the pamphlet back out the jail cell. You know, I wasn't making a decision to turn my will and life over to Jesus Christ or anybody else. Now you're getting to see the influence that I was under when I wasn't under the influence of alcohol. I was under the influence of me and my head was crazy. And then I'm supposed to go and write down what happened. My attorney told me don't ever write that stuff. And it gets worse. Gets worse. Go tell somebody. You know, you talk about alcohol, drinking, alcoholism, intoxication, intoxicated, impaired judgment. Can you imagine the shit I did that I don't even remember? Huh? I'm glad I wasn't there. That was a safety net. And then I love this one. I'm entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. If He removes them, what am I going to be? I am a defect of character. And humble? Come on, man. Ain't nobody on Armitage and Humboldt Park in Chicago, Illinois that I knew was ever humble. And I never sat in a tavern and said, hey, man, are you humble? But I tell you what I did do. I copped a PhD in talking shit. Huh? You talk about committees. Mine talks real crazy, you know? And I'm humbly supposed to ask God to remove my shortcomings. I said, what is that? He said, look it up. Then I'm supposed to make a list of everybody that I'd harmed. And I'm supposed to go tell them. I'm supposed to ask for forgiveness. You know, people are tired of me. Huh? They're tired of me. When I sat in that hospital in St. Catherine's Detoxification Unit, I hadn't talked to my primary family in 4.5 years. 4.5 years. They didn't know where I was. But I want to go on, you know, and I'm supposed to continue to look at myself on a daily basis and be promptly admit when I'm wrong. You know, I was still a victim in that moment. I wasn't wrong about too much. You did it to me. You know, I hated this when them old-timers would say there are no victims in Alcoholics Anonymous, just volunteers. You know, I sat there volunteering to be a victim my whole life. You know, I mean, how could I defend against everything that had happened had I not remained a victim? If I had to take responsibility and be accountable for my actions, I truly was in trouble. And then I'm supposed to speak through prayer and meditation. Can you see it? To improve my conscious contact. Here we go. Hallelujah, man. I didn't come here to get religion. I didn't come here to hear about Jesus Christ. I come here because I don't want to be in that condition again. And I'm scared. I stayed sober primarily on fear for months. For months. I was scared. And I'm supposed to seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. What is God's will? And what if I don't like it? You know, I've been doing this since 1968. What if I don't like it? And then I'm supposed to go out and help you? Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I try to carry the message and to practice these principles in all my affairs. None of it made sense. If I would have just done what I was told to do and I didn't have that old man that came to me and walked me through this, I'd have never made it here. Somebody said, well, you know, we lose a lot of them. I think we lose more than we keep. You know, it ain't a lie, but it is a lie. To say, don't drink, go to meetings, and read the book. I want to tell you a couple things that happened to me since I'm supposed to be talking about the steps. One is, when Tony said that in the meeting that night, and he said, listen, I never walked in a tavern and ordered a blackout, it just happened to me, it clicked. Like this. That I truly was powerless over what happened to me when I put that in my body. And you know, we used to hear this a lot, and we still do in some places. You know, we came to, and we came to believe. You know, I'm glad we weren't a religion. But the more I came around, the more I heard, the more I listened about spirituality and God, the more I started to understand that spirituality and God was about serving something outside of myself. And the more I realized why we were chosen, the reason I was chosen was not to sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about me, but the reason I was chosen was to help somebody else. And that was serving something greater than me. But the most powerful thing that ever happened to me in my early recovery was when I went to Dirty Louie's house and he set me up. And he gave me a little card. We got some of them back there. They'd been doing it for years. And I had been going to meetings, and I had been going to the little room behind the big book. We had this great big book. It was 16 feet high and about 12 feet wide. And behind it was a little room. And if you were a newcomer like me, you went in the little room and you sat and you heard the first step every day. Every day in the little room was the first step. Every day I heard the first step. And if you ever read in the 12 and 12, the last two paragraphs in the first step talks about that place. Huh? That bottom that we gotta hit, and the only way that we're gonna practice the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is to experience that bottom. And I had been doing that, but I had no spirituality, I wasn't properly armed with the facts with me, I wasn't in service, I wasn't in unity, and I wasn't in recovery, I was just attending meetings. And I was trying to look good. Trying to fit in. Anyway, I went to Dirty Louie's house and something happened. I wanna tell you this. He said, I know you ain't going to like this, but you got to do it. You heard that before, haven't you? Well, as of date, there ain't a whole lot I've experienced that I've truly liked. I miss the hole in the wall, you know? I miss the hilltop. I miss the nightlife. I miss it. But I know that drinking's killing me. And that old man got down on his knees, and he said, get over here. And for the first time in I don't know how many years, And this happened in the first 90 days of sobriety. He got down on his knees, and I got down on my knees, and he said some kind of prayer. And then he said, read that card. You know that card. That third step prayer. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And you know, I could have never got what I'm about to tell you in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me right away, hey, pay attention. This is Chicago, Illinois. Pay attention. Watch how many people are coming in and out of here. Who'd you sit next to last night? I'll never forget this. I sat next to a guy the night before that was chronically drunk. Because meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous don't keep us sober. The steps do. Meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous give me an opportunity to learn and share. But what I do when I'm not in Alcoholics Anonymous is more important than what I say and do when I'm sitting there. Ain't that the truth? Yeah. So I'm on my knees, slick hip and cool, man, but I'm losing the slick hip and cool because I ain't feeling too good anymore. You know, I'm getting thrown a lot of ammunition, man, and I'm starting to wonder, do I want to even be properly armed with any of these facts? And I don't like what I'm reading. It's getting close to home, but I'm going to tell you what, I don't want to be like Eddie Reinsdorf. I don't want to bounce in and out of here for 23 years and finally make it when I'm 56, broke, busted, and disgusted with yellow jaundice, alcoholic hepatitis, and chronic cirrhosis of the liver. And how many of us come here in that condition? Yeah. Yeah. Raise your hand. This was the beginning. How many of you read about a personality psychic change? Yeah. And isn't that pertinent to being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? When I got on my knees with Dirty Louie and I said the third step prayer, I realized in that moment it clicked just as much as walking in that tavern and having that blackout and being powerless over what happened. It clicked. I had a personality change. This much. I felt something different. And for the first time in my life, I realized what I had been in bondage to. You ever look at what you've been in bondage to? I've been in bondage my whole life. To me. But I blame the state. I blame my family. I blame the neighbors. I blame the police department. I blame, but I've been in bondage to me. And when I wasn't drinking alcohol, I was as miserable as I was drinking alcohol that last year. You been there? Anyway, I did that third step prayer, and shortly after that, I was doing a four-column inventory. Anybody ever been there? My God. Huh? Resentments. Fear. Sex. Pornography was going off in my head when they said that. I think I was slipping into a sexual meditation at the thought of it. And you know, it wasn't that hard. When I started really looking at it, I wrote resentment and I listed it. Cause. Okay, the cause of this resentment is this. The effect, it's just bondage and blah, blah, blah. You know, the column I hated was over here. And Louis said to me, and if you're not new, you'll get this, you're driven by how many forms of self-delusion? We're going to break a few of them today. Yeah, they say 100, I wonder. But some of those delusions started breaking. And for the first time in my life, how many of you ever sat in a gin mill, a tavern, a bar, a nightclub, wherever it was you drank, in your living room, and ever thought about your part in anything? I wrote it and did it the best I could. And then the hard part, I went to him and I sat down, and for the first time in my life, I was as honest as I could possibly be with another human being about who I was. And he told me through the whole fifth step that I'm properly arming myself with who I am. And as a result, I'm going to find out what truly is wrong with me and what truly is wrong with me. And some of you are going to debate me on this. Isn't all the issues I think I have? Because in every issue is me. And I'm the problem. And if I start tackling issues, I'll lose my character defects. And my character defects are really the difficulty in living in sobriety. And ain't that the truth? He said a lot of us forget these steps. We call them the forgotten steps, 6 and 7. And most of us have difficulties in our lives as a result of not allowing ourselves to practice principle over the defects of character. He told me that principles dominate character defects. And as a result of that fifth step, I started truly to understand a little bit about what I was recovering from. And then the most difficult thing happened for me. I don't know about you. But I had 72 amends to make. I made a list. And I only got a couple minutes here, and this is emotional for me, but it started my sobriety. I thought doing the third step prayer and having a little tiny psychic change and truly conceding to my innermost self that I really am what you are. And I thought properly arming myself with these facts about me was a stage of recovery. And I was really starting to get well, so to speak. But the hardest thing I ever did was the ninth step. I'll tell you a story, and then I'll close it up pretty quick. I sat in meetings for a long, long time. And I'd made a lot of these amends, these 72 amends, telephone, letter, some in person, but I skipped around the most difficult. And the most difficult amends I had to make for me, she was only about that tall. She was 72 years old. And my home group pushed me to go there. And I knew I wasn't a true member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I was talking stuff again. I knew I was in bondage and I was trying to look good to you, and I knew deep down in my guts, 3 inches behind my navel, I didn't look good at all, because I knew I hadn't done all the work, and I knew I hadn't gone full circle with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous until I did this. And you know, I knew that I only worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous for me, and I was still selfish and self-centered. And unless I did this and started working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with you and for you, and not just for my selfish ass, I wasn't going to stay sober. And I got in the car. And I drove 165 miles, and I'll tell you what, I've been some places and I've been around some blocks in my life, and the most difficult thing I ever did in my life was in 1986. I got on an elevator. I rode it up so many floors, I got off the elevator and I stood in the hallway like a big baby, scared to death. Then I knocked on the door and I had called her and told her I was coming. And then she opened the door and it was my grandmother. And my grandmother hadn't seen me in over 5 years. And of course, tears were in her eyes and she grabbed a hold of me and hugged me and said, "I'm so happy you're here and I'm so happy you're alive and we've been worried about you and where you've been and blah, blah, blah." And finally, I got in the house and I sat down and I said, "Grandma, I've been in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. You ever heard of it?" She said, "No." And I said, "I got to do something here today that I don't want to do." And I tell you, in the back of my mind, I was getting angry. I could see Dirty Louie. I could see Big Jim M. I could see Tom R. I could see my home group sitting there, and I'm thinking, why did you send me down here? I don't want to hurt her. She doesn't even know I injured her. You told me I got to do this even when they don't know I injured them. It's easier to do when I've injured you and I go back and say, "Hey, I stole $20 from you. Here it is." And I sat down on the couch, and to make a long story short, I looked at her straight in the eyes and I felt terrible. That big hole I had 3 inches behind my navel, I had it again. And I looked at her and I said, "Graham, I did something to you you don't know nothing about." And she said, "What is it?" I said, "Well, when I was staggering around here drunk, I used to steal money from you. And I used to crawl in the back window of your house and steal your pills." and I'm sorry. And I know you didn't know that I did that. And my grandmother looked at me after a few minutes, and my grandmother said to me, "Les, I'm not angry at you. I'm so proud of you. You're turning out to be the kind of man that I always wanted you to be." And I cried. For the first time in almost 20 years, I sat with a family member that held me outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, outside of hiding in meetings, outside of all that stuff I was doing. And for the first time in my life, somebody was validating me again as a man. Isn't that powerful? And you know what God did for me that I couldn't do for myself? That old woman got on the phone and she started making phone calls, and she was the elder in our family, and she called my mother, and she called my uncles, and she called my family, and she told my family, "He's trying to make it." And when I went back to make amends, doors were open that I could have never opened prior to that. I could have never got that hiding in my home group. And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, to the folds of Alcoholics Anonymous, to those old timers in Chicago with 40 years of sobriety. And for the first time I looked at them and I knew what they meant. I had emerged into a new way of life, and that the promises were going to start coming through to, for me. And I was going to be restored to dignity, and I really could hold my head up. And I don't have to agree with everything, but I have to be right with me, God, and you. Does that make sense? And for the first time in my sobriety at that time, that I truly understood that it isn't working the steps, it's experiencing what happens to you as a result of doing them. You hear me? I could take a college kid out of Carthage College, out of University of Chicago, out of DePaul University, and I could put them in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for 90 days, and they could sing the tune of Alcoholics Anonymous as well as somebody who's been here 20 years. But they'd never experience it. And for the newcomer in the room today, if you want to get well, if you want to get better, if you want to get sober, you got to experience the 12 steps and the power of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because really, isn't that what it is? I've had so many friends. By the way, I've been here since May 15th of 1982. I've watched the parade come through Alcoholics Anonymous. People getting drunk, falling off the chairs, and I ask them, "Why do you get drunk? You know how we're supposed to interview them? Huh? What happened?" And the bottom line, man, is they didn't work the steps. They believed that lie. Don't drink and make meetings. That works for about 2 or 3 months. Then it's time. Or they believe that other lie, you know, some of these newcomer killers we got. You know, don't work the steps. Don't worry about it, you know. I'll tell you what, if that old man hadn't taken my drunk, junky ass over to his house and put me on my knees in 90 days, I probably wouldn't be here today. And I do believe this. If life was fair, I'd be drunk or dead. Last thing I want to tell you, and you hit it. Right now, as I'm speaking in New York or L.A., in Chicago or Miami, up in Minot, North Dakota, or down in New Orleans, somebody's dying of alcoholism, and guess what? They didn't have the opportunity I had this morning to get up and talk about God, the steps, and talk about sobriety, and talk about love, because there's people dying all around me. And it's real egotistical for me to sit in Alcoholics Anonymous and just talk about me and my issues, when the only reason I have this gift is to give it away. And ain't that a trip? Yeah. And no, I am not a Nazi. I'm not from Germany. I am not a Nazi, and I'm not a big book thumper. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't call me names because I work the program. And guess what? My biggest struggle in the 18th, almost 19th year of my sobriety is the same struggle that I had in the first year of my sobriety, my character defects. Huh? And putting principles over them, that is difficult. But I'll tell you what, I got more joy and more happiness than I've ever had in my life. and I got a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I haven't laid in a detoxification unit for a long time. Huh? And there's people in this room that know me, and the thing that excites me most about my sobriety, this guy keeps giving me 1 minute, 2 minutes. He's got me all screwed up. Hey, it's over. The thing that excites me most about my sobriety isn't doing this. The thing that excites me most about my sobriety, Jerry said he didn't like it. I probably couldn't do that delegate thing. I don't have a personality for it. But the thing that excites me most is to crawl off in the corner behind the church with a newcomer that's still shaking alcohol and tell them what you told me. But more importantly, take them through what you showed me. You see, this isn't an intellectual or an emotional program. This is an action spiritual program. I can't intellectualize it, and I can't emotionalize it. If I got a sponsor, I can talk about both, but the real deal is about giving it to you. 5 seconds?
Take what it takes, man.
Thank you.